Content warning. The following podcast contains discussion of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and incel culture.
You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
It's sleepover night on Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. Helen Hunt may have officially won the Oscar much later, but really it was to atone for not receiving it for Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Then, hear our hearts break in real time as we realize things about Pretty in Pink.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Wendy.
Hey there.
Dave.
Hello.
And Will.
Light as a feather, stiff as a board. Light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And Wendy, this was your week.
Yeah.
What did you bless us with?
The girls of Holy Grace have a reputation to uphold.
Day-o. Say day, you say day, you say day, you say day.
Had a deal.
We made a deal when I was 7 and a half. Nightlife was the Muppet Show.
Sorry.
I can do any step you can do.
I hate him.
He's a guy and he's alive. What's there to hate?
He's just, you know? I mean,
Is he gonna call you tomorrow?
I think so.
You are grounded.
We're in this thing together, huh?
We sure are.
The moves, the music, the movie.
Let's do it.
Girls just want to have fun.
Well, our first movie is 1985's Girls Just Want to Have Fun. This was written by Amy Spies and directed by Alan Metter, who also gave us Rodney Dangerfield's Back to School. And you can kind of tell. So the film tells the story of Janie, who's a high school senior, and her career army dad has just retired and settled the family into a new home in Chicago. And as Janie tells her class on the very first day of school, she's been to 13 schools, all with the same little Catholic girl uniform, but she has always dreamed of coming to Chicago, the home of dance TV. DTV, it's an after-school TV show featuring dancers, the latest hits, music news, and it's super 1985. Janie is befriended by the school weirdo, Lynn Stone, played by a very young Helen Hunt, and ends up going to the open auditions for some new DTV regulars. Along the way, she meets a cute boy, a villainous rich girl, and Shannon Doherty. There's lots of sneaking out and first love and, I mean, who do you think becomes the new DTV regular in the end? Hint. It's Janie. Who's a young Sarah Jessica Parker. But the thing that I love about this movie, it's more than that. Like, it's a young woman's coming-of-age story. It's a story of women supporting one another. It's a working-class dad supporting his kid's dance dream. It's like Sergeant Dad realizing his little girl is all grown up. And Janie gets to find her place in the world. It's just that since this is a dance movie, that place includes a lot of spandex and really big hair.
Thank you, Wendy. I suppose there's not a lot of plot in this movie.
No, there's not. But that's not really the point of this movie. No.
What is the point of this movie?
The point of this movie is to cash in on Cyndi Lauper's hit song, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Mm-hmm. And so, who is this? Is this New World?
Yes.
Yep.
New World.
Oh, yeah.
New World wants to cash in. So they licensed the song and the title. But you know what? Cyndi Lauper and her team didn't actually write the song. It was written by a man in the 70s. And she changed it up a bit. So, this film is called Girls Just Want to Have Fun, as opposed to Wanna, because that was one of the changes that she made. It doesn't actually feature her version. But it does kind of capture that, like, mid-80s teen girl excitement. Although, I don't know how much fun... I don't know. Janie has to go through a lot. Her family's pretty tough on her. Lynn Stone is having a lot of fun. Helen Hunt is fucking delight in this movie. And at point, like, I mean, at this point, she's like a super established. She's got at least one Oscar, right?
You're talking about now, right?
Not in now, like in 2024. In 2024, she's super established, like super, right? But at this point, what we know her for is jumping through a plate glass window on PCP in an ABC after school special.
And Trancers.
Yeah, and Trancers. Year before this.
And Quarterback Princess.
Thank you. Is this anybody's first time seeing this movie?
Yes.
Will, you've seen it before?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yes!
So, Wendy, why did you pick this?
Because it's a fantastic, fun, goofy movie. I mean, it's super 80s, right? It's a super cult movie. Like, who has even heard of this movie? It's one of those movies that I think people don't always know exist. But we had a recording from HBO and watched it all the time. It's absolutely not the kind of movie that you would think, like, young Wendy would enjoy, but I loved this stupid-ass movie because it's just fun. And when I think about it, like, it has that thing that, like, Rock and Roll High School has in a certain sense, where, like, it has, like, the strong female friendship where the girls support each other. They're not competitive. They're never snarky with one another. They're just there to be best friends and support one another. And they both get to, like, realize their dream in the end. And I love that about this movie. It really is, like, a girl's coming of age story where, like, yeah, there's a romance, but he's just kind of also there. Like, he's not the point. It's nice that she ends up with, like, the young John Mellencamp character, but, like, the romance isn't the focus of the story. There's also a boy in it.
I feel like you're being very disrespectful to scholars of the Lee Montgomery filmography.
Did he make much after this? Didn't he just kind of...
Not after this, but he'd had a career as a child actor before this.
Oh, it's a tough transition.
He was the main character in Ben.
It's a tough transition. Like, this is a transitional movie for Shannon Doherty, I think. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, she's just, like, getting out of all the kid roles and getting into, like, teen roles.
Yeah. And I think this is, like, after she did Little House on the Prairie, or is this before? I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure this is after.
Okay, well, thank you, Wendy. Will, what did you think of this?
So this is a film that I am familiar with because I had an older sister. And literally, like, most of the time, she chose a lot of the films we watched. So, you know, I saw this, I saw Hairspray, I saw, like, all of these, you know, like, here are young women dancing, and so I was familiar with the film for years, and then I think I blocked it out for, like, a decade afterward, until eventually I ended up seeing it for the first time, like, not first time, but for the first time in a while, like, a few years back, and no, it's a fun film. Yes, it is light on plot, but you know what? I think it works so well, and why I think it had, like, a success afterward, you know, because it didn't do well at the box office at all, is because it feels like it is a very standard sleepover movie. If you're having a sleepover and you're a young woman, your parents are like, okay, well, we'll take you to the video store. You can get a couple movies. And this is, like, one of the ones that, you know, you and your girlfriends are going to pick up, and you're going to be like, yes, this is something we can watch. We'll watch this. We'll watch Clue. We'll watch Lady Hawk. Lady Hawk's a bad one, but if you're, that's more when you're a high school, like, drama kid, like, watching movies with your friends, but that's beside the point. Lady Hawk was on my mind because Lady Hawk came out the exact same weekend. Mm-hmm. And I only know that because the other reason why this movie is familiar to me is because it came out 2 days before I was born.
God damn it, Will.
Hey, I spend most of my time with people younger than me. I have to feel like I'm not the youngest person in the room occasionally.
Okay, fair enough.
I know what that feels like.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah, no, it's a fun film. Everyone does great performances in it, and yeah, I think it's a pretty good one.
Okay, cool. Dave, how about yourself?
This is my first time watching it. I mean, basically, until Wendy brought up watching it, I don't think I even knew it existed. Never mind sort of having seen it before. I can absolutely see how, if you're a 12-year-old girl watching this for the first time, it would become your favourite movie ever, and that you would watch it loads of times. Absolutely, yeah. This is very much kind of keyed into that kind of demographic. And for the most part, I liked it. I will say it did feel almost like two films laid on top of one another with sort of two different protagonists. So you've got the kind of Dirty Dancing / Step Up kind of dance competition, oh, the family doesn't approve type stuff with Sarah Jessica Parker's character. And then you've got Helen Hunt's character, who's fantastic, mm-hmm. but she feels like the protagonist from a completely different film. And there are bits when they sort of cross over, like when they kind of prank the like the debutante party and stuff like that, which is, you know, great. But yeah, it just sort of feels like it almost feels like two movies kind of swooshed together. And so you get large tracks of it where it's like, you know, the dance competition and the romance and stuff. And then Helen Hunt comes in to kind of create chaos for a bit. I did love how she kind of took on Shannon Doherty as a sort of chaos apprentice. Like when they got hold of the invite to the ball, she's like, "You come with me. We're gonna go cause trouble." And she's like, "Yes," because she thinks Helen Hunt's awesome, which, you know, she is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's kind of like an interesting sort of heightened reality to it. So, like, when the ball gets invaded by all the people they've given the invites to, the first hint you see of that is somebody forward somersaulting through a window.
Yeah.
And you bring the Jack, I'll bring the Coke.
Yeah, and it's like, well... And this kind of, you know, this kind of movie reality of it. So no one calls the police because he's got an invitation. So yeah, I mean, I'd love to throw all these people out, but they have invites. My hands are tied.
You told me to only bring people that have invitations.
It's not that kind of thing that happens in wrestling where someone's banned from the arena and then they turn up because they bought a ticket. Like,
See, if as long as you have an invite, you're allowed to destroy the country club. It's on the back of the ticket. It says it right here.
But yeah, but ultimately, I can't be too mean to this film because it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. It's doing something that definitely appeals to the audience for which it was made for, which, let's be honest, isn't a man in his mid-40s. So, I know, I am very aware that I am not who this film was made for, and yet I still walked away enjoying a lot of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, well done.
Yeah, I'm basically right there with you, Dave. Obviously, this is not a movie that was made with me in mind, but I can absolutely 100%, you know, like you said yourself, if I'm 13 years old in 1985 and I see this movie, I'm going to love it. I'm absolutely going to fucking love it. Because this movie is, I mean, it's a teen comedy, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. It's a teen comedy that's not actually aimed at the people that it's about. It's aimed at the people that are a little bit younger than they are. It's sort of like aspirational. This is what it's going to be like when I'm in high school, and this is going to be so great, which is a demographic that's done super, super well since the beginning of, you know, modern pop culture. Everybody wants to kind of experience the excitement of what it's going to be like a few years from now. And I think that this movie does that really, really well. Like, nobody has a high school experience like these people have, but that's okay. It's not that kind of movie. Mm. The acting, the actors are pretty much to a T perfect. Like, everybody is great in this movie. The only real variant on that is the debutante, and that's what the role calls for. The role is calling for basically Reggie Mantle. You know, the role is calling for the evil rich, you know, rich person that makes life difficult for our heroines and gets their comeuppance at the end. You know? You know, right down to the father saying, "Will you just shut up?" That's what that role is for. First of all, I think it's interesting that 80s teen comedies are such a staple of the genre of film that we talk about, and we've done so few of them, because they tend to be really fucking gross. But in fact, I'm looking at the list and I'm only seeing, this is like the third one we've done. They've all been female centric and they've all been brought to us by Wendy. You know, we've done this, we've done Heathers, we've done Rock and Roll High School, which is 79, but it's basically an 80s teen movie. I have more than once like looked at the list and said, oh, we should do something in that vein. But it's like, no, these movies are really fucking awful seen through a 2024 lens. And it's really nice to kind of see a movie like this. And again, I think it's because it's focusing on, you know, the young women in that time period and giving them agency and giving them, you know, they get to be the heroes of their own story, which is really cool.
If I can just say, like, in that vein, though, we do have a problematic character in this film. Jonathan Silverman's character, Drew, is a sex creep, and he straight up essays a woman on camera.
I kind of didn't understand what he was there for. I think you could have taken him out of the film entirely, and he would have, and you wouldn't notice.
Like, I guess, like, the guy had to have a friend, but I don't know. Super fucking creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's like a stock character in this kind of movie. The guy's best friend, but also the guy who is out to make money, out to be kind of creepy, out to be... The creepy guy that gets shot down a lot is somebody that you see in a lot of movies like this. Which is... Yeah, it's a big misstep in an otherwise very enjoyable experience.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the function of that character is just kind of to make the romantic male lead look good, in a way, you know. So you've got somebody much worse to hold him up to. So that, oh well, but this guy's fantastic because this look at the creep he hangs out with.
Yeah.
But this guy is kind of noble and cares about dancing and, you know, and he's really focused on rehearsing and wants the best for his dad and all of this sort of thing. So, yeah, I think, in a way, like, there is a similar character in the other film we're going to be talking about, which I think is a bit more complex. It's the same thing, but in a much more complex way. Mm-hmm. And... like you say, Dan, I think it's a staple of the film, but I think if I had to kind of guess as to why they're always introduced, it's always kind of to show that the romantic lead is a good guy for whom is kind of worthy of the affections of the protagonist, because he's not one of the other many creepy guys around.
It's true. Jeff Malone, he's not a creep. Like, he's a legit good person. You know, he's a little bit aloof. Right, he kind of, I don't want to say he like insults them, because I think it's done in a playful 80s flirtatious kind of a way, but he kind of like goofs on them about their uniforms when he first meets the girls. But overall, like, he's a pretty stand up guy, you know, and he's just trying to figure shit out, and he's like, he's good to his sister, like when his dad's job is threatened, like he's gonna back off and like put his dream on the back burner to like protect his family. Like, he's a decent character in a time when a lot of like teen boy characters were unfortunately not decent characters.
Yeah, he genuinely, and I love the relationship he has with his sister, because he genuinely loves her and genuinely wants to take care of her, even if, you know, even as he, you know, teases her and embarrasses her in front of his best friend, who she has a crush on. Chan Dorley's delightful in this.
Oh yeah.
Like she's got the teen sidekick thing down perfectly.
And that's part of why, you know, Drew feels like a necessary character, because Jeff already has someone to talk to in this awesome little sister.
Mm-hmm. That is such a good point. She could just be the sidekick. she could be the excuse for, like, getting them to connect. Like, Drew is entirely unnecessary. Was there some kind of Jonathan Silverman contractual obligation?
I feel, it almost feels like there was a draft of this where he became Helen Hunt's love interest and they decided, no, we're not going to do that. And he just kind of stayed in because he used to have a purpose.
And that would be like such the trope, right? Like the weirdo friends hook up, or maybe they hook up first.
Yeah.
But then they saw the two of them on screen together and just realized that Silverman was not in Hunt's league at all.
Yeah.
No.
Even vaguely.
And also, I mean, let's face it, Helen Hunt didn't need a man in this movie.
No.
And it was really nice that they didn't try to force her to get one.
I love her storyline. Can we talk about the fashion icon that is Lynn Stone?
Oh, God, yes.
grab your popcorn, folks. You just learned something.
It's Will and Wendy talk about costumes. So they go to a Catholic school and they all wear the same uniform, but Lynn has customized all of hers with Velcro so she can do quick changes. Like, she can reverse that little pleated plaid skirt to like a little fitted pleather mini skirt, and she can take the sleeves off her blazer, and it turns out she's got fur on the other side of it. She wears a beret with a giant fucking grasshopper on it and makes it look good.
Yeah. Like, it's to the point where when she, at the end of the movie, like, she takes over the news segment out of nowhere because, hey, she just happens to be there. And it's like, yes, you know, you're already dressed well enough to become the new Julie Brown.
I fucking love that. I love that so much. I love when she goes to break Janie out in the end, like, she's wearing like a tactical jumpsuit and a belt made of bullets to go on this tactical mission. And she looks, it's true though, right? She's armed. She like gets the dog that's attacking them to go away. She looks so good that when Ricky, like the music news host, storms off in a huff, Ricky, who is played by Christy Summers, who, as we folks might recall, played the sexy frog lady in Hell Comes Frogtown. When she quits, Helen Hunt becomes the new over-the-top music news host, and it's amazing. She comes in, does she come in on a chariot or on a litter? Yeah. In a chariot. Oh, fucking amazing. Everything about her is amazing. And again, the grasshopper beret, and she makes it look good.
Yeah. When she was doing that quick change at the start, I was suddenly reminded of that bit in Community when Troy's been secretly going to dance class and have all those trousers that fly off. And at one point he just goes, I have been spending a lot of money on breakaway clothing recently. I quite like the dad. He's an actor I know from stuff, and I can't. He's from The Rocketeer. That's why it suddenly clicked. That's where I know him from. He's one of the FBI agents in The Rocketeer.
He's Ed Lauder. He's like a prime. Hey, it's that guy from this time period.
Yeah, it's just this second clicked where I know him from.
I do like, again, I could heap praise on Helen Hunt's character all day, but like, you know, they show early on that, you know, they're watching this show and the dancing is cool, but that's what I want to do. That's a cool job, pointing to Ricky. You know, just kind of come on, be fabulous, be snarky and leave.
Well, and she knows she's not a strong dancer. Like, she goes to the auditions because why not? But she knows she's not likely to get on through her dance, but she's like, she has something else, right? She has star quality.
And the thing is, she's really going to support her friend. Like, yeah, because, you know, she's feeling a bit sort of shy about it, and she's worried that, like, she won't go. So she's going to kind of push Sarah Jessica Parker to go, because she thinks she'd be really good. So it's all about, like you said before, Wendy, about the whole friend supporting friends thing.
Yeah.
But when she decides, initially she decides she's not going to go and because her dad said no, and then she changes her mind and runs on the bus, and she's about to kind of put her on board the moving bus. Well, that was just like a great moment of friendship in the film.
Yeah.
And I love too that she just sees the opportunity to kind of take control of her destiny and just grabs it.
look, hey, look, there's a chariot. You know, like, she just decides to go for it. And it works out for her, and I love that. I also love, again, the little note that they don't come back to it, just they just mention it, is that, you know, she's saying, yeah, my name is Lynn Stone. I hate it. As soon as I turn 18, I'm going to, you know, become Blast Hard Cheese or some shit. You know, like...
Honestly, if you're going to be, like, on television, Lynn Stone is not a bad name.
No, it's not.
And just all the bits she does for running interference for the, for, yeah, the couple and stuff, when she talks the nun into doing the pommel horse routine. Yeah.
That nun on the pommel horse gag is fantastic.
Any film that features nuns doing gymnastics is a good film.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we got a certain list. The, you know, we get the, you know, deleted scenes from Gymkhana, I'm sure, somewhere.
I mean, honestly, like, had the trampoline girls in Black Belt Jones been dressed as nuns, that would have taken the film up to an entirely new level.
Yeah. You're already at an 8. This is how you get up to an 11.
9, yeah.
Sister Pickles. Sister Mary Pickles. Here we go.
You go. That's what it needed. Sister Mary Pickles.
Sister Mary Pickles of Our Lady of Eternal Dancing.
The music on that show is so amazing. It's so like peak early 80s dancey trash. I love it. I love every song. Danny was laughing at me because I still know most of the words to those songs.
Like, I don't even... Like, were they... actual commercially released songs, or were they just kind of like generic kind of for the film kind of music to dance to songs? Because I don't know enough about that kind of music.
That that very first one from the audition, I think the auditions ones, was like a minor dance hit.
Right.
I think there were like dance bands that like got to get their songs on the record. I think they were like written by actual bands like working in the genre, or I imagine in that genre is probably mostly producers and hired singers, right?
I know I've heard that cover of I'm Dancing in the Street before many times.
That, is that the one that's at the audition?
I can't remember, but...
There's that, like, one that's, like,
I think it's playing over the montage.
Yeah.
And I love that last one, that Dancing in Heaven song. Anyway, it's good. For... given the song that it's missing... Given its title, it's missing one really important song, but the songs they got are pretty fun.
And I did love, like, a lot of their routine depended not on her learning something new, but on him learning something new.
Yeah.
Because she's teaching him to do, like, the front flips, so they can do the coordinated front flip together. And that's, like, you know, the big move that they're kind of keeping in the chamber for when they need it.
Yeah. It's very much like Johnny and Baby doing the lift, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not sure they can pull it off, and then when it's time, they actually pull it off.
Yeah.
Because she can pull it off. That's new to him.
Yeah. And the film has, like, one of my favorite little things as well, is somebody looking at the camera and saying, this means war. Like, I cracked up at that. Was it the bitchy girl? Yes. But that's beside the point.
I kind of like her as a villain. Like, in general, like, I'm kind of over, like, girls fighting with girls, women fighting with women over petty bullshit like this. But she is really just, like, an over-the-top, campy villain.
Yeah.
And her comeuppance is lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and... All of her hatred is pure snobbery. I mean, we're going to talk about at least one other mean girl today where it's like, no. All of her hatred is her being a horrible piece of shit. And no, in this case, it's just, she's a snob. I feel like, you know, if she is put in an experience where she is forced to learn, she will actually come out of it better on the other end. As opposed to, you know, some of these, you know, villains in these 80s teen movies where it's like, you're a horrible teenager who's going to become a horrible adult.
She's also very clearly been spoiled by her father, who kind of acknowledges that he spoiled her.
I thought we were working on the movie. No, I want to be on the dance show now.
Seems like that would be easier for him to fix.
Yeah.
It was bugging me too. Speaking of the father, because I spent the whole movie like, where do I know this guy? He's the man with no eyes from Cool Hand Luke, and I was like, oh my god, it was driving me insane. I mean, I feel like I should know my really sweaty movies.
I mean, there's not a lot of movie to talk about. Like, it's delightful and it's fun, but there's not a lot there, mm-hmm. right?
My only other note is the Dixon sisters were robbed.
Seriously.
Justice right. for the Dixon sisters.
Amen.
Start a hashtag.
And they're stealing the Marx Brothers mirror routine.
We are Dixon sister truthers on this podcast.
People ask me to describe what this podcast is about.
I'm glad I finally know.
I want all the gory details.
His name's Blaine. So beautiful.
Blaine? Oh, that's a major appliance. That's not a name.
He's a Richie.
Woody?
It's just his family has a lot of money.
Does he have strong lips?
How can you tell?
Do you feel it in your knees?
I felt it everywhere.
Strong lips.
I love this woman, and I have to tell her.
All you gotta do is try. In the magic, yeah, watch the crew. You got the comeback to do, baby.
We're closed.
You know what an older woman does for me?
Changes your diapers.
Touche.
Hey, this is Steph's party, Blaine.
You shouldn't be allowed to invite just anybody.
Why are you getting involved?
The girl was, is, will always be nada.
Say it.
You're ashamed to be seen with
no,
me.
I am.
You're ashamed to go out with me.
You like him, he likes you. What his friends think shouldn't make any difference.
I just want to let them know that they didn't break me.
Told me you couldn't believe in somebody who didn't believe in you. I've always believed in you. I just didn't believe in me.
All right. Okay. Next up, we paired this off with another 80s movie named after a song, and that was Pretty in Pink. Wendy, you asked to cover this one as well. Would you like to do that?
I did, yeah. So Pretty in Pink is a 1986 teen romantic comedy, sort of, directed by Howard Deutsch. Is it Deutsch? Howard Deutsch, and written by John Hughes, who, again, was inspired by a song to create a movie around that song. In this film, our protagonist is Andy Walsh. Andy is a high school senior. She lives alone with her very loving but really not super responsible dad after they were left by her mom. They don't have a lot of money, but Andy can sew, and she absolutely wins the award for best wardrobe from 1986 that in retrospect looks like you're wearing grandma's couch. So I will say, like, this movie is really going to be impacted by that one phrase, not grandma's couch, but in retrospect. And I hope that we talk about that more later. But Andy's goofy best friend, Ducky, is absolutely obsessed with her, believing it's love, and fawns over her constantly. She enjoys the friendship, so she kind of puts up with it. And they support each other through growing up on the literal wrong side of the tracks. At school, there's a clear line between the Richie kids and Andy and her friends, which are just the rest of the kids in the smoking courtyard in the 80s. But despite literally not making any sense or even getting to know one another, besides the most superficial interactions and one really cute computer lab trick, Andy falls hard for Blaine, a major appliance played by Andrew McCarthy. They navigate the disdain of his Richie friends, including Andy's bully, Benny, a real c**t.
I mean, it's not wrong.
I don't believe much on this show, but...
And I use that word lightly.
You don't?
If I say it, I mean it. And Blaine's best friend slash Andy's sexual harasser, Steph, played by a young James Spader, who is a high schooler who lives in suits and no socks loafers. They also navigate the not really that helpful advice of her dad, Andy's manager at the record store, played by a young Meemaw in latex and big hair. The rage of Ducky as he realizes that Andy is not going to fall for him, and Blaine's missing backbone. Along the way, we see Ducky's fierce performance of Try a Little Tenderness in the record store, Meemaw falling in love, and the ugliest fucking prom dress to ever grace the screen over one of this greatest soundtracks of all time. 1986 Wendy would tell you 5 stars, go out and see it immediately. 2024 Wendy wants to talk to you about what it means when a woman says no, incel culture, and the parentification of eldest daughters.
Was this anybody's first time seeing this?
Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. Wendy, thank you for covering that. So you kind of started to get into it a little bit, but what was your relationship with this movie growing up as opposed to now?
I mean, I fucking loved this movie. I was the audience for this movie. In 1986, what am I, like 14? So I'm just starting high school. And the soundtrack for this movie is like opening me up into a whole new world of music. And I am about to abandon like the top 40 hits forever. Andy made like thrifting and being a weirdo cool. Like everything about this movie spoke to a very young Wendy. And I loved this movie so fucking much. I've seen it a gazillion times. You know, we talk about the local art houses here a lot. One of them does a John Hughes series usually once a year. And I used to go religiously every year. And it was at one of the local art houses watching this movie maybe less than 20 years ago when I realized this movie was going to break my heart if I didn't stop watching it. And I couldn't stop watching it. And then it broke my heart.
I'm sorry. We'll definitely get into that. So, Will, why don't you tell me what were your thoughts about this movie?
So, I somehow avoided this like for years. My main exposure, a lot of John Hughes, I didn't actually see until after I was until I was at the very tail end of my teens. Mm-hmm. I think I saw 16 Candles before this one, and obviously I'd seen Breakfast Club before either of them, because Breakfast Club is a national treasure. But anywho, to the point, I think it is a film that is formative, but there is some stuff in it that this time watching it, I'm like, holy crap, I feel like I'm supposed to be feeling sympathetic towards Ducky, but I really don't. And by the end, I'm like, okay, cool, Ducky, you grew up when you realize that a girl is allowed to say, I'm not interested in you, and you take it seriously instead of just being fucking Steve Urkel.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not to say that John Cryer does a bad job, because, I mean, John Cryer does a good job. It's just the material he's given to work with is not, it does not service his character well. But, I mean, the thing I'm always taken away with this film is how I wish this was a movie about Iona and not about Andy. Because I could watch Annie Potts for days.
I would love to see the Annie Potts focus sequel.
Yeah, because like anything going on with her character, I'm like, why are we watching this? I mean, yes, I get it. It's called Pretty in Pink, and it's all about, you know, Andy, you know, stepping into her own and everything. Her last couple of days of her teenage life before graduating, but I don't know, there's just something about it that throws me off in a way that I think a lot of other John Hughes films don't.
So Dave, this was your first time seeing it. What did you think?
Yeah, this was interesting. It turns out this is a favorite of Gillian's, which she suddenly realized she didn't own. She was like, oh, I've got Pretty in Pink. I was like, well, sure you have. We were looking at the shelves. I was like, no, it's not there. So a DVD was purchased. And we watched it last night. Weirdly, I got a... You know how there's a lot of high school films that are kind of based on kind of 18th century literature?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the social structures are kind of the same. So, yeah, yeah. Like things like Clueless and Easy A, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I got a real Pride and Prejudice vibe from Pretty in Pink.
Back to that.
Because you've got sort of Blaine is sort of like the Mr. Darcy kind of character, especially there's the bit in Pride and Prejudice when he first attempts to propose to Lizzie and says that sort of like, even, you know, I'm proposing to you even though I know it's against my social standing and not in my best interest to do so. And he expects Lizzie to take that as a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there felt like there was a real... It wouldn't amaze me if it was in some way an influence on the film, because there is that kind of class dynamic there. Because mm-hmm. obviously a lot of this film is about the class divide.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real kind of... that's kind of like a genuine piece of adversity rather than just sort of like, you know, he's cool and she's viewed as not cool. It is much more fundamentally like he is from money and she is not. Yeah, I think John Cryer is fantastic in this film. Like Will says, the actual character of Ducky is weird. There's very weird decisions, and I kept thinking the whole thing would have worked better if Ducky was gay.
Mm-hmm.
Like if Ducky was Andy's friend, Andy's gay friend, and I think like, had this film been made 10 years later, I think he would have been. Like, you could have done the same plot beats without the kind of icky, unrequited love side of it. That, you know, he could still have been angry at her for kind of siding with the, you know, like being into like a rich kid, considering how much crap the rich kids give them and stuff, and their friendship would be on the line. But it would just be their friendship. It wouldn't be about the fact that kind of Ducky being kind of in, like being feeling spurned, essentially. And in a way, I think it's, I mean, for all of the ickiness of it, I think in a way it sends a good message insofar as, hey, look, you know, the girl you like may well not like you, and that's okay. And I think there's a lot of young men who would need to see that,
mm-hmm.
you know. But yeah, obviously the performances are all fantastic. And yeah, and considering I've not really seen Annie Potts in much apart from Ghostbusters, it was just really great to see kind of Annie Potts in full flight in this, and she's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, James Spader is just like, he ruled the 80s as, you know, the douchebag. the guy you want to hit. And he's obviously in cracking form here. I mean, like, yeah, he does exactly what's required of him to make you hate him. Maybe I found the kind of the ending a little lackluster, but you know, ultimately, I think Harry Dean Stanton's great in this. I'm sort of pleasantly surprised to see him, because it's not the kind of film I normally associate with seeing Harry Dean Stanton in. So sort of, when I saw his name in the credits, I was like, oh, I sort of sat up and took notice a little bit. And yeah, he's really nice. He's like really, really good. Like in a way, a very un-Harry Dean Stanton role.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, overall, I liked it. I would quite happily watch it again, but it's a film not without its issues.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Dave. I saw this movie for the first time fairly recently, actually. I think it was when Fathom released it a few years back, and Wendy, you and I went to see it. That was my first time seeing it. Because, again, this is not a movie that I studiously avoided, but it just wasn't really... I wasn't really interested in it as a kid.
Well, again, with like us at that age weren't the audience for this.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My sister went through a big Molly Ringwald period, so I know that it was around there. she was that age, you know. I have to be honest, with the exception of Ferris Bueller, which now, of course, has its own issues.
Yeah.
I've never actually been a big fan of John Hughes, and I don't know if I can put my finger on why that's been. They just, his movies, at least the teen movies, you know, have never really, because I know he also, like, he wrote a couple of the first two Vacation movies and
Curly Sue.
Yeah, Curly Sue. Well, I mean, you know, Home Alone and all the kids movies he did in the 90s, but for some reason, Ferris Bueller was like the only John Hughes movie that I was ever really able to connect with. And now, of course, I watch it. And, you know, obviously Cameron is the hero of that movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I do love the Fight Club reading of that film.
Yeah.
big fan of that.
Yeah, I do too. But like, oh my God, just I watch it now. And it's like, oh man, I hope this is the time when Rooney catches him. Fuck that punk. But yeah, I don't have a ton of history with Pretty in Pink. And like everybody else, the actors are really good, generally speaking. Benny's kind of a bit much. Like even as the evil bully, Benny's a little over the top. And this is not a movie, unlike the first movie we watched, this is not a movie that, like, over the top feels correct.
What really got me about Benny was, having looked at the film on IMDb afterwards, that's Ellen Tye from Battlestar Galactica. Yes.
It is.
It was like, what?
For the most part, the acting is really, really good. Especially, I would say, John Cryer. As much as I really resented his character in this movie, and we'll definitely be getting into that, he played it super well. He just has no fear and just completely went for it. And it really, really worked. You can definitely this is one of those rare movies where you can understand why the nerd gets bullied. Like, I'm not even joking, really. I'm just like, you can understand why other kids really don't like Ducky. Because Ducky is an asshole. Ducky is an obnoxious punk. And, you know, I can understand why he doesn't do so well socially in this environment.
I mean, when Andrew Dice Clay is having to explain to you why you're possibly being viewed as an asshole, you know you fucked up.
Yeah.
Fucking love him in this, which is a thing I've probably never said about Andrew Dice Clay in my life. He's so good as the doorman at the club that won't let Ducky in.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the same club exterior as when they go dancing and girls just want to have fun.
Holy crap, it is.
It is.
Yeah, nice. They both did some shooting in Chicago, so I'm wondering if that's a club, or it had been a club. I'm sure it's not there anymore.
They also shot in L.A. It could be some backlot or something in L.A., but it's the same club, exterior.
And yeah, I mean, Harry Dean Stanton, I forget that I like Harry Dean Stanton. Like, he's not somebody that's on my radar for some reason, but whenever I see him in something, I like his character, and he was great in this. And again, he had a character with stuff to do. Like, he had an arc, and I liked that. But the problem with this movie for me, generally, and again, honestly, 99% of it was Ducky. I like you, and therefore I'm entitled to you, is not a good look. And I know that it's supposed to be, it's so romantic that he won't take no for an answer, except it's really not.
And it's kind of like extra worrying, because I haven't read in the trivia that John Hughes wanted Andy to get together with Ducky.
Yeah, that's the original shot ending that was shot.
That's the original ending, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got, what? What about the rest of this film made you think that that was a good idea?
I mean, it was a trope at the time, right? But and it was kind of a societal norm at the time, but it's not okay.
Yeah.
Like, look, like, it is not okay. Like, he believes he can get Andy by wearing her down. And, like, she's constantly saying no to him, and he hears her because he backs off in the moment, but he's just, like, waiting to push again, right? He's constantly pushing. He goes to her father to ask for permission to marry her. And has to hear her dad, who's kind of like a fuck up, like, he loves her and he's trying, but he's a mess, explain, like, maybe it's not going to happen. Like, you got to talk to her. You can't talk to me. When he finds out she's going to go on that date with Dane, with Blaine, he's not just, like, upset. He's, like, the scary kind of angry where you kind of wonder if this man you've had in your life all this time is going to hurt you.
Yeah.
He kisses Iona without her consent.
Yeah.
He explains that he stalks women that he likes, and then we see him continue to stalk both Iona and Andy after this happens. And then, in the end, he almost got her anyway.
Mm.
That's the original fucking Andy. She's supposed to go off with Ducky. And if you, the next time you watch it, look at Andrew McCarthy's hair in that final scene. It's a reshoot, and he was in a play, and they had shaved his head, and so he's got this weird fucking wig that looks really gross.
I thought he looked a bit strange in those scenes.
I mean, he looks like he's sick, and they slapped a wig on him to try and make him look better. And maybe he had to lose weight for the play. I don't know.
He did.
Okay, so he looks like he's unwell. But anyway, he almost got her anyway, and like that is the problem with the 80s movies.
I mean, like earlier when I mentioned compared him to Urkel, it's literally the exact same thing because. Yeah. If you go, because even the last season of Family Matters, Urkel finally freaking wears down Laura, and they're getting married if the series went on for another season. And it's like, that is the lesson we're telling these kids. Hey, if you wear down the girl, eventually she will end up with you. You're entitled to her.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note that, you know, one of the reasons they changed the ending was that they put it in front of a test audience. The test audience is booed that ending. It's like, if your test audience thinks that this guy is too much of an asshole to be with the person because he wore them down in 1986, you've overplayed your hand. because he's like full on incel in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like Elliot Rodger incel in this movie. It's really, really bad. But I think another reason that they changed the ending, and I really think that it's kind of amazing that they thought of this, was that the studio didn't like it because they didn't like the idea that the movie ended with rich and poor don't mix, stay to your own kind. Which, yeah, I can kind of see that. I can see that being kind of problematic.
Yeah, I mean, I think your love story about people in different, like, social classes is supposed to end with them kind of crossing that barrier, right? Like, that's how it's supposed to end. And I don't even know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but, like, Andy and Ducky was not okay. I would have rather seen her with Simon.
I will say, and I feel like this was a missed opportunity, a moment when I got very excited in this movie was when Ducky attacked Steph, and I thought, we have the opportunity for one or both of these characters to receive the hospitalization-induced thrashing that they
both deserve. Yeah.
I really wanted to see them both get hurt so badly in that scene in the moment. And I'm not a vicious, like, bloodthirsty person.
No.
But that is how much I hated both of these characters.
You wanted Peter Griffin versus the giant chicken. Just
I wanted Peter Griffin versus the giant chicken.
Yeah.
You want them like in the hospital room, like in the adjacent beds and the full body casts.
But at the same time, I'm kind of glad that their fight is entirely one-sided with Steph being, you know, just punched down.
Yeah, oh, that's fucking great, right? Because you think that he's just going to, like, absolutely destroy Ducky, and Ducky has enough rage in him.
Yeah,
but it turns into a kind of a slap fight at the end. Like, neither of these guys actually knows how to fight.
No, but only one of them is lying on the ground covering his face while he takes his beating. And that one is Steph.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of what makes it a realistic fight, though. Like, if you ever see anybody fighting in real life, that's what it becomes. It's just kind of just flailing arms, pulling at each other.
Yeah. I got to say, years and years ago, I was hanging out in Harvard Square. And in Harvard Square, there's this area by the train station called, it's called the Pit. It's like a sunken platform that before you go down into the subway. And I don't know if it's still the case, but at the time, you saw a lot of skate punks hanging out there. Mm-hmm. It's a gathering place. And one time, I was just kind of hanging out, like kind of doing people watching. And two of them got into a fight. But it was like the saddest, most pathetic thing I'd ever seen, where it was just like these two kids literally slap fighting each other, like doing that. And it's like, oh, these poor kids. like they're trying to, they were like puffing themselves up and trying to seem tough. And it just turned into the most pathetic display you've ever seen. And that is kind of what I saw Ducky and Steph's fight turn into at the end.
Can we talk a little bit about Steph?
Sure.
Yeah.
Asshole.
Yeah.
Right? So the movie kind of sets up that he's been hitting on Andy their entire high school career. And she very much knows, like, he just wants to, like, fuck her and move on, but he's kind of stuck on her because she keeps saying no. But every time he talks to Blaine about her, he just puts her down, calls her a low rent piece of ass or something like that.
Yeah.
Just is super insulting. In the meantime, he keeps trying to get her to go out with him. Cause he's just a fucking dirtbag. And he knows, he gets so upset when he sees that she likes Blaine that he just constantly like leans on Blaine for liking Andy. He's just a fucking monster. He stalks her in the parking lot. Like, she's putting up with a lot of harassment in this movie.
I mean, of course, one of the things that kind of makes it worse is James Spader is one of those actors who plays the character like that with such relish.
Yes.
That it makes what's on the page so much worse because he kind of really throws himself into it.
He does. He's so good at this kind of a role.
Yeah.
And this was his first time playing a role like this, I think, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't know.
It kind of became his stock in trade. Like, I know the year after this, he made, like, four movies where this is basically the same character he played.
I think I read in the trivia he was offered Blaine, but wanted Steph because he thought the villain would be more fun to play.
Well, he was definitely right.
To this day, Robert California is now the only thing that I can actually see him as. It's weird to me to not see him be Robert California. I don't know why that is, because he was obviously not that for so long.
I see in my head he's always that character he was in Less Than Zero.
I mean, like, the main thing I associated with is Alan Shore in Boston Legal, but
oh yeah,
yeah.
He's actually super funny in Mannequin.
Yes,
and that's not a movie I throw around because. Because that obviously is a role that was written for a much older actor. Yeah.
But, and yeah, hilariously, Andrew McCarthy stars in Mannequin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can call being the male lead in Mannequin starring a mannequin.
Like, the only person who sticks in the memory from that film anyway is Hollywood. Like, that's the only person anybody remembers from Mannequin.
That's true. That is true.
He's so great.
I saw that in the theater.
Good for you.
I did.
But yeah, like, as I said before, I think they could have, you know, had this film been made later, there seems to be a lot about Ducky that does seem a little bit queer-coded. Sort of the way he dresses, the way he holds himself and stuff, and it just kind of, that would have eliminated so much of the ickiness.
When we first meet him, there are, like, choices that he makes that I think are very, like, 80s coded for gay, and it's interesting that he's not. It's interesting that I kind of like the revision that we've talked about earlier, just for him to be queer. That would be such a better story. He can still hate Blaine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's about that class thing rather than it being anything else.
Yeah,
yeah, it's super easy to hate Blaine.
Mm. Yeah, Blaine's a piece of shit.
Well, yeah, just I mean, like when he takes Andy on a date, he wants to take her to a party where all of his friends are. When Andy makes it very clear that she's not comfortable with that, and he kind of like talks around, and oh, surprise, surprise, it's just as disastrous as Andy thought it was going to be. I mean, I suppose like it's there because it's to show that they're from different worlds, because then Andy takes him to the club she normally goes to, and then he gets kind of crap from Ducky, so he doesn't fit, you know, to show that they're both from different worlds and each one doesn't fit in with the other.
But like, how long does Benny have to verbally abuse Andy before Blaine decides, you know what, maybe it is time to leave?
And that's something else that was kind of like bugged me a little bit, is there didn't really seem to be, I mean, yes, like, there is that kind of moment where Blaine backs away because he's worried about the class difference, but I didn't really see a proper moment where that caused him doubt, other than like a vague reference by Steph that his mum might not like it. I don't know, it just felt like there should have been something a bit weightier to cause that doubt in Blaine's mind, because up to that he's been totally into the idea and he's not really given it much thought, and it just like an offhand remark from Steph, who by Blaine's own admission is an ass, didn't feel like it should have been enough to give Blaine second thoughts.
I mean, I don't want to defend Blaine because I think he's a spineless piece of shit, yeah. But it does kind of seem like maybe my read on that is like Steph honed in on that because he knew that that's something that would get to Blaine. Yeah. Like he said one line in passing to Andy about how he's like the heir to like his parents' electrical business, whatever. It did kind of feel like, oh, he's under a lot of pressure from the family. And there definitely are a lot of families like that would not take kindly to that relationship. But their whole relationship was so superficial that that piece didn't even faze me. I don't even know why they like each other.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that they're together for very long after the end of this movie.
Like, yeah. she's pretty, he did a computer trick. That's what I got.
Yeah. 80s instant messenger.
Yeah, that did feel a little out of place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the guy that gave us Weird Science, like, next year, so.
That's the other movie. That's the other John Hughes movie I can watch and not hate, is Weird Science.
That's another one that's hugely problematic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Try not to think about it too hard.
Yeah,
but it's got Robert Downey Jr. with a bra on his head, so you know.
And the song is good.
Also true.
That's a Oingo Boingo song, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yes, it is.
All roads lead back. To the Elfman Brothers.
I've been thinking that I want to rewatch Forbidden Zone recently.
What? On purpose? You do? I'll totally watch it with you. I'm the one that kind of likes it.
Yeah. I like weird shit. What can I say?
Yeah. Can I just take a second also? Like we kind of mentioned with Andrew Dice Clay, there's a lot of actors who became big afterward that are just in here for like a cup of coffee. I mean, there's Andrew Dice Clay. Christy Swanson is the girl that appears to be attracted to Ducky at the end.
Gina Gershon.
Yeah, Gina Gershon's in
Gina
here.
Gershon is one of Benny's friends, and like she has like one line in gym class.
Yeah, yeah, I did a massive double take when I saw that. I was like, rewind it, I've seen Gina Gershon.
Did you see me? I've seen this movie a gazillion times, and I never realized it was Gina Gershon.
Yeah. And Dweezil Zappa.
Dweezil Zappa is not just, he doesn't just play Simon. Mm-hmm. His record is also for sale. It's like feature of the week at Trax. Yeah.
Which is funny, because again, like total coincidence, I've actually been listening to a lot of Frank Zappa recently. So that was kind of like, all right, yeah.
The Zappa Kids.
Yeah.
They were going to change the world.
Remember their sitcom?
Vaguely.
Yeah, they had a sitcom for like half a season.
Yeah. And Maggie Roswell is in here, who literally, you know, has done like half the female voices on The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose what part of, I mean, I don't know about you, Dan, but a lot of the John Hughes stuff I've seen at the wrong age. Mm. So, like, I saw The Breakfast Club for the first time when I was in my late 30s, and as such, didn't particularly bond with it. And I mean, pretty much the only thing I think I probably saw Weird Science and Ferris Bueller when I was quite young. And again, I think, yeah, like you say, it's the sign of aging when you, as a teenager, you see Ferris Bueller and think he's awesome, and then you grow up and you think he's a prick. But yeah, I think maybe just kind of like to have that special connection with a lot of John Hughes' films, you need to really be in a certain place in your life to connect with them, you know.
And that was absolutely me. Like, I was, when 16 Candles, I think, was the first of the teen movies came out, I was 12. And I saw that in a theater, and I saw all of these in theaters. And they were all on cable, on HBO for years. And I'm exactly the right age and the target demographic for these teen movies of Don Hughes. And they were so special to me for so, so long. And now they're so hard to watch.
Yeah,
I mean, I did see The Breakfast Club I was age appropriate for The Breakfast Club when I saw it, and I remember watching it and thinking it's fine. Like, I genuinely did not get why it was like this Gen X touchstone. I acknowledge that it is, and now watching it, I understand why it is. But
and you also realize that like Claire is sexually assaulted, mm-hmm. and the message of like change who you are to get the boy is bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that didn't register with me when I was like 12 or however old I was when I saw it. I just was like, all right, it's a bunch of assholes sitting in the library for 2 hours, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
like, I understand why Bender is the way he is, but that doesn't make him not the way he is. You know?
I mean, like, for me growing up, like, yeah, if it didn't have kind of like spaceships and lasers or people fighting crime in it or something, I tended not to gravitate towards it anyway. I was a person of singular tastes.
Up, see, now if everybody in this movie had a laser gun, that would have made it a much better movie.
Oh, right? Absolutely, yeah, yeah,
yeah, 100%.
If Blaine and Ducky had a lightsaber fight in the corridor,
that would have kicked ass.
Yeah, Molly Ringwald's like awesome pink car just happens to also have a pink laser cannon on the front.
Oh yeah, that'd be like a James Bond car with smoke and oil coming out the back of it and stuff. Yeah,
like little machine guns in the headlights, kind of a Black Beauty kind of thing going on.
Which. I wanted to really quickly say the one thing I am going to call bullshit on with this film is that Molly Ringwald's car is not a piece of crap.
No, it's a vintage Karmann Ghia.
And the paint is perfect.
It's a little dented up, but it's...
There's dents over it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful car that's...
Yeah.
Honestly, she should not have been able to afford under any...
No, she should have had like a shitty rusted out Beetle.
That looks like she painted it pink herself.
Maybe glued some grandma's couch fabric to the back seat.
Look like a child trying to customize its Penelope pit stops car.
Exactly. That's her aesthetic right there.
I gotta say, one thing I didn't understand, as much as I loved Iona, Iona's fantastic in this movie. Annie Potts is wonderful. Why is she hanging out with this girl who's like at least 10 years younger than she is? Like, I know that, you know, she's the manager and they work together. And I understand why Andy would want to hang out with her, especially as she's kind of missing a mom figure. Why is Iona dancing with this young girl?
It feels like a mentorship thing to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think she's getting something out of it, too. I think she's, like, I think Andy is a stabilizing force, right? And Andy's an adult, you know? She has been parentified by her father. She's the one running that household, not her father.
Right. Okay, I'll buy that.
I do think it's kind of interesting that they, you know, with the father, just the fact that his wife left him without so much of a word has just broken him. It's kind of, and to the point where Andy gets so frustrated with him at one point, he's like, she's not coming back, but he's so, I mean, in a way, almost he's like, when he's talking to Ducky about sort of like, because she's not that into you. You always kind of think, well, maybe that's how they got together. That's always like, yeah, he's trying to give Ducky a cautionary tale. Because, like, even though she left, he's still obsessed with her.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I do like that. And again, maybe this is just imprinting 2024 sensibilities on it. Like, Jack, the dad, is not just moping for his lost wife. I mean, this is crystal clear textbook depression that he's experiencing right now.
And it's
treated seriously as such, more or less. I mean, yes, Andy gets very frustrated with him, because who doesn't get frustrated with the depressed person from time to time? They're very frustrating. I know. You know? Yeah. This isn't just a matter of he can't just cheer up. He can't just snap out of it. He's got to go through this process, and he'll come out on the other side whenever he comes out on the other side. But it's not in the it's not within the 90 minutes of this movie.
Yeah,
and I like also that they didn't. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I was gonna say the Andy's frustration is born out of the fact that look, I need my dad. Like, I don't have my mum, but I need my dad. And you're so hung up on this, like, I'm having to do everything. I need you to pull your, like, I need you to get your shit together, man. And which is, and that's kind of like when they have that heated argument, which they immediately kind of realize has gone too far, and they both kind of hug it out. But yeah, like say that, like, he's very clearly just been depressed and just broken by this, and just he's having a huge difficulty coping. And to the point where, like, yeah, he's supposed to be getting a job, but he's not kind of connecting with it. And also, like, again, just thinking about, and this is all just kind of coming to me now, like the parallels between him and Ducky. Like, she kind of chews him out about not really making an effort to get a job. And she says the same thing to Ducky about not really trying in high school. Like, him acting like he doesn't. Like, it's almost like he wants to stay in high school because that's like his comfort zone. He doesn't want to move on. So, yeah.
No, that's a good.
Yeah.
That's a really good observation.
That sapped the energy from the room.
Well, I think that we're kind of running out of movie here. Does anybody have anything else?
It's got a great soundtrack.
It does.
One of the best.
Yeah.
One of the best. I think for a lot of folks of my generation, this soundtrack was opened the door to a whole new kind of music that we weren't getting. And you could kind of use this to go track down these bands you had never heard of and find them at the weird indie record store in your town and, you know, hear New Order for the first time, or just this soundtrack is really influential on Gen X.
And what's interesting to me is that, like, some of the best songs in the movie aren't actually on the soundtrack album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, the, you know, OMD song is not on the soundtrack album. Like, the Rave Ons were in there.
Oh, I think it is. The Rave Ups.
The Rave Ups, sorry. They did two songs, right?
Yeah, Positively... Positively Lost You, I think, is the name of the other one. And that's just a great fucking song anyway.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm looking at the track listing and neither of them had... I'm sorry, If You Leave was on there. I apologize. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. I know, again, I know it was because that was probably the first time I heard OMD. But yeah, the Rave Up song is Positively Lost Me is not on there. And it might be the best song in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in 16 Candles, what's her name? I don't remember. But Molly Ringwald's character has like a Rave Up sticker, I think, in her locker, maybe, or on one of her books.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like her musical taste was maybe influential.
Yeah. On Johnny's. Well, I mean, she's the one that gave, right? She's the one that gave him the psychedelic first song to...
I don't know. Is she? I know that he had the song and he wrote the movie for her around the song. And that's a great fucking song from a great album in 1981. It's got some really great songs on it. I think Mr. Jones is on that, which is possibly my favorite song. I love the Psychedelic Furs. That's one of those bands that I used to go see every fucking time they came through. Oh, She Is Mine is on there, which is a beautiful song.
All I know is that Pretty in Pink was an insanely fun song to play on garage Rock Band.
I'm sure that's true.
It was an insanely fun to play on that game.
So that's Pretty in Pink.
That's Pretty in Pink. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining us, and to you out there listening, thank you very much. Please take care of yourselves. Drink some water. Go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. If you or a loved one have been let down by remembering a John Hughes film fondly, ask if Frank Henenlotter is right for you.
More?
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize.
I don't know what's happening right now.
I'm so sorry. I got caught in a note, and I'm...
That's okay.
I'm super good at this.
Could I speak to Mr. Toland, please?
Yeah.